Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's another big speech at the GOP convention tonight, the nominee himself, of course, but it's last night's speech by his running mate that's in the news. The business of political fact-checking coming up on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday. It's the 30th of August today. Good to have you with us. Congressman Paul Ryan's speech went almost 40 minutes or so last night, 3,500 words, plus or minus. You pile that on top of the thousands of hours and millions of words of speeches and press conferences and plain old remarks that have been uttered this election season, and you know what you got, right? It's a business opportunity. Sabri Benishore reports now on the rise of the political fact checker.
Last night, Vice Presidential candidate Paul Ryan said this.
$716 billion funneled out of Medicare by President Obama.
And recently, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid made the claim that Mitt Romney
basically paid no taxes in the prior 12 years.
Statements like these have kept people like Bill Adair pretty busy.
I would rate that true on the truth meter. We've seen a real explosion in fact-checking in the last few years.
Bill Adair runs fact-checking outfit PolitiFact. He says, by the way, the claims above are either totally false or at best highly problematic. In the last 5 years, PolitiFact staff has grown from 2 to 36. Another group, factcheck.org, has grown exponentially too. Why? Well, it's not because politicians are suddenly fibbing even more. There's just a lot more media outlets reporting more, quote-unquote, facts.
There is more political messaging now than ever, because there are more ways to reach voters and anybody than ever.
Lucas Graves is a research fellow with the New America Foundation. He says the internet has made fact-checking a lot easier.
Both in terms of doing research so that you can respond, journalists can respond very quickly to statements that politicians make, but also in terms of making this information available to the public and keeping records.
But the question is it working? Brooks Jackson started factcheck.org.
Both sides don't seem to care. They keep repeating claims that have been shown by fact checkers to be false or grossly misleading.
But as one fact checker pointed out, they don't write for politicians, they write for the public. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
So picking up on that, politicians can talk and pontificate and speechify all they want. But once all is said and done, voters have to figure out what they really think.
And the latest poll number suggests margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup, where what they do is ask Americans what they think about things. He's back to give us a little bit of an attitude check. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you, Kai.
You guys just had some numbers about who Americans think is going to win. Give me those numbers, and then I have a question for you.
All right. 58% of Americans think that Barack Obama will be elected president on November 6th. 36% say it'll be Mitt Romney. And those data come from the exact same people who, when you ask, who are you going to vote for personally, are split right down the middle.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So the ballot itself, when you ask American voters who you're going to vote for, is split. But when you say, all right, tell us who's going to win in your heart of hearts, it tilts significantly towards Obama. And a lot of that is caused by Romney voters who say, I'm voting for Romney, but if you really press me, I think Obama's going to win.
Okay. Now, how much of what happens in presidential elections is a self-fulfilling prophecy based on that split of who people think is going to win, if you take my meaning?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You've put your finger on something that's called the bandwagon effect, which some people have argued there is a momentum or an inevitability created by somebody who people think is going
right.
to win. Hard to prove that. There's also the theory, Kai, that there's an anti-bandwagon effect, so that if people think they're behind, they're going to work even harder. That would be Romney supporters in this situation get elected.
Another thing that's come up in this election, of course, Frank, is who's better on the economy. Governor Romney wins that one fairly handily, but President Obama has the likability factor going for him. He polls much stronger than the governor does on that one. Is either of those predictive?
You know, they're both predictive, and they both kind of describe the election. How both gentlemen should play this out is a fascinating question. My view is that probably we all do better playing off our strengths. Now, that would be for Mitt Romney, rather than trying to be likable suddenly in his speech, really hammering home the economy and why he thinks he can do a better job than Barack Obama.
And then the president next week, I mean, does he give a likability speech?
Well, you know, that's his strength. So presumably he just has to be himself, because he's been himself over the last 4 years. And the one thing we see in the data is Barack Obama is substantially more likable, based on what voters tell us, than his opponent, Mitt Romney.
Frank Newport, he is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. There's more of our weekly segment that we do with them. It's called Attitude Check. You can find it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Traders broke out of their haze and decided to do something at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. Sadly, it was selling mostly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Item one, as we set up this next story, the cost of college is going up, as we've heard. Item two, the unemployment rate for young people in this country, 16 to 19-year-olds specifically, is almost triple the national rate. So it's not all that surprising that some of those young people are passing up college and the debts that come with it, and instead trying to find new ways into their workforce. And some companies are welcoming them with open arms, the Northern California utility Pacific Gas and Electric among them, in part because half of PG&E's workforce could retire in the next 5 years, an exodus that's being called the Silver Tsunami. As part of our series Clocked In about young workers finding jobs, Youth Radio's Jalen Burns reports.
Straighten your leg, drop into it, put your foot down there by the stripe. Concentrate on that technique.
That's Ray Atkinson, playing the role of professor at a pole climbing yard in Oakland, California. He's pretty much training his replacement.
I've worked for PG&E for 35 years, so I've been climbing poles since 1980. And technically, I could retire anytime after January 1st.
Atkinson has a mustache, hard hat, and deep voice. He's your typical Bob the Builder. His student, Olutunji Lawrence, is a skinny teenager, inching up a utility pole for the first time. He's just 6 feet off the ground and struggling.
Right there, I want you to drop straight into that pole. There you go. That's what we're looking for. Now, you can lean over this side. There you go.
Lawrence is 19 and the youngest in his class. The goal of this training is jobs. That's why PG&E calls it the Power Pathway.
It's cool. They prepare you really well for it. You're never going up blind.
Lawrence graduated high school last year. He says most of his friends went on to four-year colleges like UC Berkeley and UC Santa Barbara. He considered college, but instead decided to focus on a job because he knows people with master's degrees who still can't find work.
If I can get a job now and work towards that education, that's a great position to be in instead of having to go through 4 years of college and owe a whole bunch of money and have no way to pay for it.
If Lawrence finishes his 9-week boot camp, PG&E says he'll be a top-tier candidate for a job. Jeff Wilding is a director of electric operations training. He says trainees like Lawrence are a lot like minor league baseball players.
The analogy is really that if you go recruit somebody out of high school or college on a baseball team, they have to go through that whole farm system before they can get to the major leagues. Linemen, in this case, being the major league. Those are our pros.
There are a ton of steps to reach the pros. But even the starting job pays $47,000. If all goes well, Lawrence could be earning $100,000 by the time he's 24. So, what's the catch?
If they can't do it safely, we really can't afford to have them with us.
Wilding calls the Power Pathway a win-win. It benefits PG&E because they're able to test out job seekers before they apply. And for job seekers, the trainings are free, fast, and could lead to a lucrative career. So, what's the catch?
We get lots and lots of applications.
A recent job posting for pre-apprentice lineman positions was only open for 5 days.
13,000 people applied, and we have 60 jobs this year.
Which makes PG&E about 40 times more selective than UC Berkeley. At least, until the Silver Tsunami takes its course. In Oakland, I'm Jalen Burns for Marketplace.
Jalen's piece is part of our series Clocked In from Youth Radio's New Options Desk. They're stories of how young adults can get work. Remember that scene in The Wizard of Oz where the guy says, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain? Yeah, well, there was a little bit of that with Apple today. The website Gizmodo got its hands on a copy of the training manual for Apple's Genius Bar employees, the ones in the blue shirts who help you when your Apple device has a crash or a freeze. Yeah, them, except they'd never use the words crash or freeze, as Marketplace's Eve Trow reports.
Apple fans obsess over even the color of a box, says technology writer Chris Null. So pages and pages of training secrets? That's a big find.
Absolutely. There's going to be delight in ripping back the veil of how the company works.
But no mystic hand of Steve Jobs apparent here. The Genius Bar training manual is mostly regular old corporate speak. I'll play the customer. This Mac is just too expensive.
I can see how you'd feel this way. I felt the price was a little high, but I found it's a real value.
Feel, felt, found. So that's like a classic sales technique.
Cheryl Harris covers consumer issues for the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
I feel the same way you do. I felt that way a lot before, but now I've found all of my fears, they've been resolved.
Training manuals usually come to light only when there's a lawsuit over something like sales tactics. She says this is merely curiosity. It's fun to think of all those smart, techie people sounding like, well, robots. Here's a sample conversation from the manual called Fearless Feedback.
Hi, fellow genius. I overheard your conversation with your customer during the last interaction, and I have some feedback if you have a moment. Is this a good time?
Wow. I've never heard a conversation like that, exactly like that.
Stephen Harris does tech support here at Marketplace. He's worked at the Genius Bar. Interactions there were pretty scripted, he says. Apple had company-specific language for everything, down to saying portable computer instead of laptop. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
Coming up, sorry, Charlie.
150 years ago, virtually no one in the United States or Canada ate tuna.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, there are some new worries over, wait for it. Hang on, wait a minute, wait. Yes, Europe sent stocks back into the red today. The Dow Industrials off 106 points, 0.8%. Bottom line, 13,000 on the nose. The NASDAQ off 32 points, 1%. The number there, 3,048. The S&P 500 slipped 11 points, 0.75%, 1399 at the close. A drop in iron ore prices to their lowest level since 2009. Battered mining stocks today. Shares of BHP Billiton lost nearly 4%. Caterpillar stock burrowed down nearly 2%. Bond prices, I'm glad you asked, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged down to 1.62%. All right, I know you didn't ask. You're listening to Market Play.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases factory orders for July. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke delivers a speech on monetary policy in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And on August 31, 1935, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Neutrality Act, prohibiting the export of American weapons to foreign nations at war. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You heard the numbers a couple of minutes ago, right? The S&P? Well, change is a-coming. Next week, one of America's most iconic companies loses its place in the benchmark index. Sears is getting the heave-ho. It's a pretty straightforward situation, actually. Billionaire investor Eddie Lampert owns a majority of the outstanding shares, which means not enough Sears stock is being publicly traded to merit it being part of the influential S&P. But the end of the company's 57-year run on the S&P 500 brings with it some big questions about the stock's future. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Just what does it mean when a company gets removed from the S&P 500, especially one of the charter members of the index that used to promote itself as the all-American store?
Sears for America Shop.
Clearly, Sears is no longer at the top level of American retailers.
Manhattan College stock market expert Charles Geist says this move only adds to the recent spate of bad PR for Sears, but the company was quick to point out it's been one of the best performers on the S&P this year, with the value of its shares up more than 80%. So what gives?
Removing a stock from an index is not any kind of investment recommendation whatsoever.
David Blitzer is chairman of the index committee at Standard & Poor's. He says stocks come and go from the list all the time based on the rules. So why did Sears shares tank by more than 7% today? Professor Geist says that mutual fund you own may have just dropped Sears from its holdings.
A lot of fund managers will try to emulate the performance of the S&P 500. Apply the stocks within the S&P 500.
And S&P's Blitzer says that can mean a temporary blip in a stock's value.
When a stock is added to the S&P 500, its price typically rises around 5% over a few weeks, and then over the next 3 to 6 months, it will give back that gain.
That's not a hard and fast rule, though. Some stocks actually end up doing well after they're removed, but it's also true some companies have ended up going bankrupt. As is always the case with the stock market, there are no guarantees. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The music streaming service Pandora has something to hum about. Today it reported better-than-expected quarterly revenues this morning, but the musicians whose music gets streamed are singing a different song, and it's a sad one. They say Pandora is trying to push legislation through Congress that would let companies pay performers less in royalties. Sally Herships has that story.
There is one thing Pandora and musicians agree on.
There's a fundamental unfairness right now in the world of radio.
Tim Westergren is the founder of Pandora.
Which is that internet radio is held to a very, very different standard when it comes to rate setting for royalties than any other form of radio.
And that's where it ends. Last year, Pandora spent $137 million on royalties, about half its revenues. Traditional radio, AM and FM, even Sirius, only have to pay songwriters. Pandora also has to pay performers. Jack Lerner teaches internet and technology law at the University of Southern California.
The deal is actually structured so that the more Pandora makes and the more listeners they have, the more they pay in terms of percentage.
Lerner says Pandora's future may not be sustainable, so the company is pushing for new legislation it says will allow it to pay the same royalties everyone else does.
The way to correct that isn't to lower everyone's payments and pick the pockets of artists.
Ted Kahlo is executive director of the Music First Coalition. He says he's happy with the royalties Pandora is currently paying.
The way to correct that is to requiring terrestrial radio to make those payments and also requiring anyone who is at a rate below Pandora to pay the rate that Pandora pays.
USC's Jack Lerner says Pandora is paying too much in royalties. But at the same time, thousands of artists are getting their work aired. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Tomorrow in New Delhi, Indian economists will get their latest growth figures to chew on. Quarterly GDP over there is expected to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 5.3%. Economists, not to mention certain politicians here, would love to post that kind of number. But in India, anything short of 9% or so is a bit of a letdown. Because as Indian politicians know only too well, a stuck economy means a bleak future for the millions of new young people looking for jobs every year. Christopher Worth reports.
On this quiet side street in Mumbai, there's a big, brightly lit sign that displays India's official population, just over 1.2 billion. And each night at midnight, Rajesh Vishwas Rasale changes the numbers to reflect how many new people the country added over the course of the day.
Population change.
Rasale is a security guard at India's Institute for Tracking Population Growth. The institute estimates India adds about 58,000 more citizens every 24 hours, which never ceases to amaze Rasale.
I'm happy to do this job, but every day the population of India is increasing so much, it makes me a little worried.
For India, a growing population was supposed to be a good thing, what people like Adil Zanobhai of the consultancy McKinsey in Mumbai call the demographic dividend. He says the idea is that as populations in the U.S. and Europe get older, India will grow younger. Already, more than half the country is under the age of 25.
Okay, that's a pool of young workers who, if they're productively employed, can give a real boost to the economy. That's the demographic dividend.
But Zanobhai says the danger is that as India's economic growth slows, that demographic dividend could quickly become a demographic nightmare.
If you have a very large young population that you cannot find jobs for, then that creates social unrest. You know, so we would probably have a complete breakdown if the growth rate fell to 3-4%.
To avoid that fate, Zanobhai says India needs more manufacturing and big infrastructure projects to modernize its economy. That point was driven home earlier this month when India's shoddy electric grid failed and left over 600 million people in the dark. And Zanobhai says if India is really going to get millions more young people into work, it needs to do a better job educating them. At this grade school in Mumbai, the average class size is 150 students.
150 students per teacher.
Anuradha Mahajani is a teacher here. She says India's education system is failing to provide the skills that would help more low-income kids in India do better than their parents.
And the richest section of society, they're sending their children abroad to study. The poorer section are exactly where they were. Poor things, they've got no promising career.
At a cafe just around the corner from the school, Smita Singh wipes down the counter and whips up another latte. She'll be the first to tell you hers isn't exactly a promising career, but it's something. She's 23, and while she works here, she slowly plugs away at a college degree.
I don't like this job, but I don't want the next generation to be poor. I come from a very poor background. That's why I'm working and studying, to make a better life for the next generation.
Singh says with all the talk of India as an emerging economy, she'd always imagined that in 20 years, that next generation would live in an India that looked more like the United States. Now she says she's not so sure. I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Christopher's story came to us with the help of the International Reporting Project that's in Washington, D.C. We eat, Americans eat, that is, almost 30% of all the canned tuna consumed on the entire planet. That's a whole lot of tuna salad, sure, but it's also a good point of departure to talk about how we came to eat tuna in the first place, because it's really only been about 100 years that tuna's been popular as a food here. Andrew F. Smith is a culinary historian. He's also the author of a new book about tuna fish called American Tuna. Andrew, welcome to the program.
It's a joy to be here.
Let me go to the subtitle, actually, first. The Rise and Fall of an Improbable Food. Why so improbable? It's a handsome fish. It tastes good. What's the problem?
That's what us Americans think today. Yeah. But 150 years ago, virtually no one in the United States or Canada ate tuna.
Because why?
The bluefin tuna were extremely large. It can be up to 1,500 pounds. And they were very hard to catch with the equipment that they had. With the smaller tuna albacore, for instance, they were an oily fish. And when you cooked their red flesh, it turned into an unappetizing brown color, as they reported in the 19th century.
How then did we get from that to grocery store aisles filled with more tuna than you can shake a stick at, and also sushi restaurants serving really expensive raw fish?
The tuna canning industry, they figured out a way to get the oil out of the fish in the midst of this. And then they said, we've got a good product here, but we need to promote it because no one knows what this is. And so they said, it tastes like chicken. They did. So virtually every tuna canner jumped on the wagon. And although only one major brand is Chicken of the Sea, they all use the chicken as a means of promoting it. And it was low cost, high protein. World War I came along. Other protein sources were rationed. And all of a sudden, everybody started eating it.
Yeah. Are we overfishing tuna? I mean, are we going to run out like we have cod and so many other fish?
The best estimates are 80% of the Atlantic bluefin have disappeared in the last 40 years. And the likelihood of bluefin tuna either in the Atlantic or the Pacific making it under current conditions is relatively low. This January, a single bluefin tuna sold for $736,000, a single fish. Lots of special reasons for that. But the point is, any fisherman who's got a chance to catch a bluefin, regardless of the restrictions that are on it, they're going to do it. With the albacore and with the skipjack, they're plentiful, and there is no stress on those populations. So it just depends on the species that we're talking about.
If I go down the street from my studios here in L.A. to Little Tokyo in Japantown and go to an upscale sushi restaurant, what are the odds that the tuna I have there will have been caught in Japan and air freighted over here? It's probably pretty high, right?
No, relatively low.
Oh.
The tuna goes in the opposite direction. We have tuna fishing here on in Long Island, and when a boat comes in that's got tuna on it, there's a representative of Japanese tuna industry that checks out the tuna. And if it's accepted, within 24 hours, it's in Japan.
Andrew F. Smith, his book is called American Tuna, The Rise and Fall of an Improbable Food. Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, just to tee you up for Mitt Romney's acceptance speech tonight. If you're on Twitter, go ahead and search for the hashtag #BelieveInAmerica. It was trending this morning, that is leading in Twitter's internal popularity contest, kind of a big deal, and it had a little promoted arrow next to it. Promoted as in paid for by whom, you ask? Well, that'd be hashtag Romney Ryan 2012, of course. It's the first time, Twitter says, that a campaign is paid to have something trend in Twitterland. If you want to follow us in Twitter, it's at Marketplace APM. Go check us out. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. The Dow sank 106 points today, 0.8%. The NASDAQ gave up 32 points, about 1%. The S&P 500 sliced away about 11 points, 0.75%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.